Hello, I'm Tom Moorman. I'm with USDA ARS at the National Soil Tilth Lab in Ames, Iowa. And I'm going to talk about E. coli and Enterococcus in a large agricultural watershed. I think a lot of Jody's comments about indicator organisms were pretty well on target. I think there's some value in looking at those, and certainly for the present time, you know, our state and federal regulators are using indicator organisms. Everybody's interested in the source tracking, and I think ultimately that's going to be a blending of tools that will really make that work. This project began we were sort of invited in by a watershed alliance, and it's sort of the epicenter of swine CAFO building in Iowa is in the counties that this watershed straddles, and they were concerned about these sorts of issues, and I think with some good reason. But being proactive, they invited the Tilth Lab in with the basic question, well, what is our water quality and what's the trend? Our large project objectives are these. Part of the project is bacterial water quality issues. The other parts are nutrients, and with the eye of looking at livestock production facilities, farming practices, conservation practices. So what I'm going to talk about today is the sources and routes of entry of water or of bacteria into the watershed. And we started off with these basic questions. What's the land use and agricultural practices? In other words, what's the setting there? And we've done kind of a classical water quality kind of study. We've set up sampling stations in different parts of the watershed to try and answer the question, well, do some sub-basins contribute more or less? Sort of the classic, let's look for hot spots. That seemed like a logical idea. What's the controlling hydrologic conditions? And are there temporal trends? And we'll hopefully be able to cover all these things. One of the things we've done is we've used aerial photography and some estimation procedures to get a handle on how many swine are present in the watershed. Over here you see pictures out of our watersheds of swine production facilities. This facility here has two different lagoons. Periodically, mainly in the fall, but some in the spring, lagoon water and sludge is mixed up and pumped into tankers and applied to the land. Some of the facilities do not have lagoons. They're what's called deep pits where the manure is stored beneath the house, and that's certainly probably the most prevalent kind of facility. This makes a nicer picture, though. So the facilities are identified from some state and NRCS maps and through the aerial photography. And what we do is we go in with GIS and determine the area of the houses, and then using some industry standards, we can estimate a potential number of swine in the each building, and then kind of sum things up. And you can see that in the watershed that we have quite a large number of these facilities. So we've gone ahead and mapped these out. There's about 78,000 hectares in the watershed, so roughly about 30 square miles. So it's right here in the middle of central Iowa. And the way we've done this is that we've summed these numbers up, for these different sub-basins. So this green sub-basin here is 54,000 hog spaces. According to the swine people that I talked to, these are filled about 90-95% of the time. So, but I think the bottom line here is in the total watershed, all three major sub-basins, we've got about 500,000 hogs, and that compares to about 5,000 people. Continuing on with that kind of theme of what our watershed looks like, we have 78,000 hectares. To give you some idea, Ames is and Des Moines are to the south. This is about 40 miles north of Ames, maybe about 90 miles to Des Moines. I-35 between Des Moines and Minneapolis cuts up right through here. So if you've ever driven up that road, you know that kind of countryside. It's relatively flat, some rolling topography, it's glaciated. The majority of our land is agricultural, and the red shows some pasture, and the dark green is woodland. And of course, as to make things a little more complicated, the pasture is of course located nearest the streams, and that kind of, we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Give you some sense of that, the upper part of the watershed back up in here is largely ditched. You see these straight stretches, and the water really emanates from tile drainage lines, and that's kind of how that looks. You see, you know, this has been ditched at some point. I don't usually see cattle on inside these areas, but sometimes you do. There's some of the land, so they're farming up pretty close to the edges there. This is a representative site down in the bottom part of the watershed, and I think that's Tipton Creek. That's one of the three main streams in the watershed, and we see some pasture, we see some woodland, and we see some cows. So we knew where the facilities were, and we made some assumptions about if producers applied manure at a rate that would be a standard nitrogen application for corn, and just sort of used the GIS to draw little circles around that until they expended all their manure, we can estimate the areas of manure treated land, and that's just shown in the various purple for different rotations. See, either continuous corn with manure, corn beans with manure, or corn beans with manure, and you can see that, you know, we have this big kind of central area here where virtually all the land is manure treated. Now we don't know that each acre actually receives manure, and we don't know that some acres might not receive manure maybe twice. Or that rate is really standard, but in a watershed of this size, it's really tough to get producers to fess up what they're doing, or even, I don't think we've ever talked to all of them at once. We've tried. And then I guess what I want to make out here is that the three major subdivisions of this watershed, Beaver Creek, South Fork, and Tipton. Beaver Creek runs up this way, the South Fork runs up this way, Tipton Creek runs up this way. They have some really different swine densities in terms of estimated swine per hectare, and pretty similar amounts of grass and pasture along there. And of course, the amount of land that's receiving manure, either it's corn beans plus manure, you know, is again much greater in South Fork and Tipton than in Beaver Creek. As I mentioned, these lands are tile drained. This is an aerial shot in the spring, and you can see accumulations of water in low spots. 54% is hydric soil, so we'd guess that at least probably 60-65% of the land in the watershed is tile drained. So how did we do our sampling? This is a little cleaner map. This shows the South Fork of the Iowa River. This shows Beaver Creek. Shows Tipton Creek. The two relatively large towns, Iowa Falls and Eldora, both of their sewage treatment plants empty out into the Iowa River, which flows along in the next watershed over here. The South Fork joins Iowa just outside our study area. A few more sections of the Iowa River, including the one below here, has now been put on the EPA 303D list for vehicle contamination. That's an area that has some recreational boating, fishing. It's pretty good looking country for Iowa. So that's what that's used for. This shows our sampling stations for the period of time that I'm talking about. We're constantly reconfiguring these to try and answer some different questions. But we have three main stations here, 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 four stations where we get daily samples, we get storm samples with automated samplers, and we get measurements of hydrologic flows. So that's very important to have those. The remaining stations we've sampled for bacteria and other constituents using a kind of a grab sampling approach, where we drive out to the location, we get a sample, and we do that for the period of time I'm going to talk about. We did that every 2 weeks during the summer months from about March till October, and then we did it monthly thereafter. So we bring these back to the lab, we analyze them, we use some IDEX procedures for E. coli and Enterococcus, and this is a way of introducing the data. Bear in mind that this sampling regime was sort of designed to try and find if we had variation within these watersheds that would give us some clue as to the possible sources. So we were looking for greater concentrations in one of these sites than another. And that didn't work very well. This is the E. coli data. These are annual means for these different sampling sites, the BCs, Beaver Creek, and no matter how we slice up this data, there's basically no difference among these three sites in Beaver Creek. In the South Fork, this site here is different than the rest, but there's not much difference between these. This SF200D is a ditch site, and it has a very, very tiny contributing area to the whole watershed. It only drains about 400 acres. And then Tipton Creek, we do see this last kind of an increase in E. coli as you go towards the base of the watershed. And maybe we shouldn't be surprised at that. You looked at the map, and it's agricultural land throughout. So it's not like we have a watershed. We have some pristine areas, and we have some contaminated areas. The data did show for both E. coli and Enterococcus some seasonal trends. And so this is 1, 2, 3 years of data. The white symbols are the E. coli. And the 365, 730, and 1095 are winter months. And basically what we see is that we see a decline in winter, and then an elevated period in the spring and summer. And we'll also see something about the hydrology. We'll go into a little bit more detail with this, but we see most of our flows, hydrologic flows, in spring and early summer. So I've taken those and just computed quarterly means, because it's a little bit cleaner than looking at all that up and down kind of business from individual samples. And and then let's just kind of go through this with E. coli. The samples from the three different sub-watersheds tend to peak here in summer months, kind of decline in autumn, reach their low in the winter, and kind of start coming back up again in the spring. And there are a few differences, significant differences, between the different watersheds. The Enterococcus behaves pretty much the same thing seasonally. There's not so much difference between the watersheds. Curiously, it seems to reach its peak populations in this autumn period rather than the summer period with E. coli. And I don't really know why that is, but it sure is a strong, it's the same trend, but they just reach a peak later on in the season. If we look at frequency of exceedance, so this would be the percentage of samples less than 100, less than 200, 300, 400, and so on. We see that roughly about 20% of our samples are really pretty clean, and you know, then we have samples over 1,000, we have about 25 to 30% for both E. coli and Enterococcus. And then using those seasonal means to compute annual means, we see that, again, looking at the difference in Beaver Creek versus South Fork and Tipton for E. coli, we see that Beaver Creek, which has the lowest numbers of swine, has the largest population, and there's no real difference, no statistical difference in Enterococcus amongst these three watersheds. I did want to talk about the tile drainage and storm flow. You can look at mean populations like that, and the frequency of exceedance tells you, yeah, if you're applying public health standards, you've probably got trouble, whether you treat it as Class A water, Class B water. You still have a large number of samples that aren't going to meet a standard. So where do the bacteria come from, and why do we have so many? And I'm trying to find my mouse. There it is. As I mentioned, a large part of this land is tile drain, and this is one of the tile drains where we've gone in and put in an ISCO sampler so that when the water level comes up, it'll take samples and we can kind of see what comes out. This drains about 3,000 acres. So normally farmers put in, you know, 4-inch black PVC pipes. Those are networked into ever larger pipes which come out in something like this. And this is a storm hydrograph for our tile station for this pipe here. And the blue is the water discharge, and the red is the E. coli. And what we see is we see a real rapid increase, and then as the hydrograph goes down, we see quite a bit fewer E. coli. It started raining again. Again, we got an increase. This is kind of hard to interpret. Normally, tile drains, or you think that the bacteria are leaching through them, but in all these watersheds, we have surface inlets. So essentially, I think these large peaks here are water that's being routed directly from the surface into the tile drainage network, and that this is more representative of actual bacteria leaching through soil. We've monitored a lot of small tile drains in addition to this one, and you can see those annual means compared to the annual means for E. coli and Enterococcus. For the three sub watersheds, Beaver Creek doesn't. We didn't have any tiles that we had access to in that. But generally, these bacteria per 100 mils for tile drains are, it's pretty clean water. So we're not. I don't think that's the major source of entry. I think it is surface flow. And if we look at storm events, we certainly, at the watershed scale, we certainly see that we get very large numbers. This is in April of 2005. So April is a month when manure is being applied. We don't have a firm number on how many acres received manure at the time of this storm. But we see at the four gauge sites where we have discharge, we see that populations of E. coli and Enterococcus are quite large, exceeding 10 to the 4 pretty consistently. I haven't shown the hydrograph, but it goes up and it comes back down. And what you're seeing is that, you know, it takes 2 or 3 days before you get back to some kind of normal level. It's very curious that E. coli is greater than Enterococcus in all of these stations. I don't know why that is, and I'll point out some other kind of curious things with that as I go along. So if what we think is right, application of manure and runoff events are kind of the situation that we'd like to avoid. And we looked at this in a field study. We worked with a cooperator farmer. He applies manure to two sites. He applies manure to one site. One site had received no manure, and we capture runoff in a little flume like this. And this house here has our ISCO sampler. This slide shows the survival of E. coli in soil at the site. This is the applicator he used that year, and you can kind of see that the manure gets splashed down on the soil surface, and then these discs sort of create some kind of little cover of that. That's the liquid right there. And the survival is the decay of the E. coli population is pretty rapid, with a half-life of about 2.5 days. And this shows the hydrograph for these two fields, the manured site and the non-manured site. And the black bars show the levels of E. coli. The black lines show discharge. So at the manured site, we get two peaks of discharge. And we're reaching a level of about 6,000 or 7,000 E. coli per 100 mils. Interestingly, at the non-manured site, we're reaching values. This sample here had just over 1,000, and this is up about 3,000 E. coli per 100 mils. So what's going on here at this non-manured site? It looks just like this. It doesn't look like a wildlife refuge, but I have to conclude that is wildlife. Birds, mice, transient populations of deer. Comparing that field situation with the stream responses for the same storm event, November 2003, the black lines are for E. coli at BC350, and the populations there are comparable to what we see at the farm site. They're going up to around 9 or 10,000 and then declining. The populations at SF400, though, are quite a bit lower. And what we think is happening here is that the rainfall wasn't even over the entire watershed. It's about 10 miles of watershed that SF400 drains. And that if you don't get rain in all of it, you don't get as big a runoff event. We got some additional data from those two different sites. This is in 2007, and again, the last manure application is quite a few months previous to that. We wouldn't expect substantial populations of manure in the soil, or populations of E. coli in the soil, and we're getting the same kind of response. We're getting about 2,000 to 3,000 E. coli per 100 mils coming from both the manured and non-manured sites. And interestingly, in this case, we've got a lot more Enterococcus than E. coli. The other data I showed you was exactly reversed. And again, I don't know why that is, but they seem to be very consistently different for these different runoff events. Where is runoff important? And runoff tends to be important in areas near waterways, the valley walls are the steepest soils in the watershed, and then these brown areas down here are the pasture areas. So that's one of the things that we're trying to pursue further. If we get higher quality DEMs, we could do some real interesting things with landscape modeling and water routing, and probably identify a lot of areas to start monitoring that aren't perennial streams but do have a lot of importance in runoff. If we go back and look at one of our year populations showing E. coli and Enterococcus, and we look at storm flow. This is the hydrograph at SF400. The white symbols show what we call base flow. We use a USGS routine to try and separate base flow from storm flow. So we see the base flow comes up and down here, and then total flow comes up and down here. So here's a pretty good storm event going up to about 1,000. Here's a larger one, here's a larger one. And if we look at our bacterial populations, this is early in the winter, and we didn't get a sample right then, but generally our populations are quite low. Here we see some populations that are part of the storm event, and they're elevated. And then we see these populations out here in August, September, and October, where we've gone quite a while without any kind of storm event. We have very low flows, but we have high populations of bacteria. So I was kind of interested in why we would have that. And one of the things that we did, we went out in September and sampled stream sediments and looked for E. coli and Enterococcus, and we found them. These are means, but the data is extremely variable. Even the means running from 10 to the fifth down to less than 100 for the different bacteria at the different sites. But basically, anytime we've gone and looked, we find E. coli and Enterococcus in sediments. So the question is are they a possible source during these late summer months when we see elevated populations in water? So we did a little experiment where we went out and we collected cores in plastic tubes, and we get water sitting on top of soil. We've got about this much stream sediment. Now the bottom part of that sediment's only important to keep water in the tube. E. coli 4 or 5 inches down in sediment, and for that to make its way to the surface and repopulate the water column, it'd be like me walking to New York City. I mean, it's a tremendous journey. But what we did with these is that we took some of them and we carefully removed the stream water and replaced it with DI water. And we did the same thing. Instead of using DI water, we used filtered water. So we basically have E. coli-free water sitting on top of this sediment, and we put them down in a light-dark chamber and incubated them at the same temperature they were collected at and looked to see if they would regrow. And the answer is they didn't. A number of people have done studies where they've gone in and disturbed sediments, and of course, when that happens, we get a plume of E. coli or Enterococcus that persists in the water until that sediment settles back down again. But we were interested in just whether free living, there's a limnological term for that, but free swimming bacteria could come from the sediments and repopulate that water column. And the answer is really no. This is the control sediment with stream water. This is a sediment, and then sediment 22 days later. This is the sediment and water treatment with the natural river water, and that E. coli had died out after 22 days. These are the populations immediately after adding the DI or filtered water, so that's a little bit of disturbance. It's 50, 60 cells, and they don't survive either. We also looked at survival in stream water. If you do any kind of approach to modeling E. coli in a river reach, you need to know this kind of factor. So we went in and we have taken water at six different locations in the watershed. We bring it back, we put it in the light dark chamber, and look at the die-off and use and basically it looks very first order. First order kinetics describe these extremely well. Here's two examples of this data. The R-squares are above 0.9 for both of these. And the average half-life for E. coli is about 17 hours and about 24 hours for Enterococcus. So, started asking the question, if bacteria are dying off, and why doesn't the watershed sort of clean itself up? If you're going through a period where you haven't had a storm event in 2 or 3 weeks, you'd expect those bacteria to kind of die off. We've already shown that the sediment isn't a source, and this is a little plot. Uses this model. So it's predicting the percentage of E. coli after some addition, and predicting its travel distance as a function of the die-off rate constant, which I showed in the last slide, the distance traveled, and the velocity of the stream. So we know our stream velocities, and I've plotted this kind of modeling result for three different stream velocities: for 10 CFS, which is virtually no flow, 50 CFS, which is still low flow, and 100 CFS, which is equivalent to the kind of flow we see in a small storm, but producing a measurable runoff event. And the way to read this is if we introduced, say, 1,000 bacteria at the Blairsburg, which is the origin of the headwaters of the South Fork, which is interesting, a tile drain. You have a concrete box, three tile drains, they're flowing out into a stream. If we introduce those at Blairsburg at 10 CFS flow, those bacteria, we'd have 0.1. This would be 90% left, or 100, at about 30 meters, and we'd reach about 1% of the added bacteria at about 50 kilometers. So our survival would be down to 1% at 50 kilometers. Well, from Blairsburg to SF450, which is in the middle of our watershed, that distance is about 46 kilometers. So the idea that die-off would be a pretty major force here in this watershed during these, if we were at very low flow. And of course, the opposite is the case at 100 CFS. So bacteria introduced at Blairsburg, 10% remaining would be 150 kilometers, and that's what would be exiting our watershed. The distance from Blairsburg to SF400 is about 46 kilometers, and from 400 to the watershed base is another basically 100 kilometers. So I think this kind of calculation is interesting, both from this late season E. coli survival story, but also if you think about that maybe this has some sort of application for source tracking, especially if you're working in a large system like this, that bacteria that you might see at the bottom of the watershed probably aren't the ones that you're seeing at the top of the watershed. Just to recap then, we have little spatial variation present within the different watersheds, with the exception that Tipton Creek seems to have lower E. coli than the other two. Watershed averages are not related to swine density. We talked about some temporal trends with, you know, quite significant differences between winter and summer. Runoff after manure applications delivers large amounts of E. coli, generally above 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5. But the concentration from non-manured land is different. That maximum concentration is generally in the area of about 10 to the 3, but it's still significant and sort of obviously highlights the need for us to do some source tracking. Watershed, I talked about that, and then we do see some differences in E. coli and Enterococcus. Over the very large picture, if we look at long-term quarterly or annual averages, we have more Enterococcus than E. coli. And then we have those curious trends in our runoff events where one group seems to be greater than the other, and I don't know why that is. I'll take questions, I guess, if we've got them. Yes.
In your die-off and travel stuff, did that just die off and no growth or regrowth potential net estimate?
That's a net die-off. The question was the die-off experiment include a growth and death curve? And the answer is it's a net, the net of those two processes. I'm not sure I know how to do the measure those independently. Yes?
Two questions. One is to clarify, maybe you have said it already, one from the presentation. It shows some interesting die-off in the soil, die-off of E. coli in the soil. Were they done with, how was the manure applied in the experiment? Was it direct? And then in your area, how was the manure typically applied? Is that injected or was it broadcasted or what type of manure?
This is how the manure was applied.
Yeah.
That's the piece of equipment on the ground that we did these measurements. And that is one of two methods. The question was, she asked about how manure was applied in the watershed. we have a mixture of commercial applicators and operator-owned applications. I'm guessing that about half the manure is applied by the system like this, where it's sprayed on the surface, then covered with discs. They call that incorporation, but you can see from this lower picture that it's not a complete process, and the other half would be the injection kind of process. This was done with the incorporation method. We have some other data with the injection method. It shows quite a bit more persistence, but I'm not sure that there's two totally different environmental regimes there. So we haven't compared those directly. We have to do what he does, and that's part of a problem with working with producers, that they don't generally have two different kinds of equipment. Yes.
How does the tile drain systems work? Is the water actually percolating to a soil level, to a soil layer, or is it coming directly into the drain?
Question was, how do the tile drain systems work? Yes, both things. Most of the tile drains are at the depth of about 3 to 4 feet, and water percolates through the soil into the drain. In low places in the fields, they'll extend a vertical tube directly up to the surface, and if you have surface water present, that will flow directly into the tube and down into the tile drain system. So when you end up monitoring a large tile drain like we did, you get both kinds of water. We're trying to figure out some interesting ways of deconvoluting those two hydrographs. And we'd like to do that for a number of reasons, but not just E. coli. So possibly some isotopic nitrogen methods, chloride. We haven't quite figured that out yet, but that's a real difficulty in interpreting, you know, the hydrology of our watershed. Yes?
I'm curious about what the sources are of bacteria in the third quarter of the year. We see the same sort of thing under the flow of ice cream. In your case, maybe it's leaking the units on site, so it's not working. You must have a source that's not working.
That's exactly right. The sources are not coming from runoff, so direct manure application seems unlikely. I think the sources in the late summer that cattle are probably a source, and I think wildlife are probably a source. So if we talk about source tracking, then that raises the question, well, how much differentiation do we need to know about animal species? I mean, certainly we'd like to know the differences between humans, deer, cattle, and swine. And then do you have some kind of generalized marker for birds? I'm not aware of one. So, but I think those are the major sources that we have.
Yeah. Your measurements are on planktonic or free-living E. coli. Have you looked at, or in our focus, have you looked at the potential that biofilm formation or the shift in growth may be responsible for some of this plate? Do you have any information on that at all?
Well, that was the intent of looking at the sediments. So if you had a biofilm on the sediment, the sediment surface on the bottom of the stream.
So you think that day alone is enough to exclude biofilm formation?
I don't know where the biofilm would be. I guess that's the interesting question. There is a report in the literature of E. coli being sort of hosted on Cladophora, which is a filamentous green algae. And I think that is something we ought to look at because we do see a lot of filamentous green algae in the streams at this time of the season.
They die off in the fall?
Yeah, they would die off when it freezes. And so that's certainly a possibility. I'm not quite sure our methods for analysis are going to be up to looking at that, so we're going to have to do something different there. Yes?
E. coli that was entered at the top of your water.
Yes.
Down along there. You're saying that it increased in numbers with distance and upon the flow.
Well, that's the modeled result, yes.
So along that watershed, there are, I'm assuming, more farmers and more manure. There's a town coming in from over here. So the E. coli that you're saying, was it marked specifically, or?
You know, that's a hypothetical case. So if we introduce some population of E. coli based on the stream die-off time and the stream water velocity, we can calculate the distance it would travel. A percentage of that initial dose would travel. And what it's telling us is that bacteria that had come in at the top of the watershed can't come out the bottom of the watershed at low flow because they should die off. Unless our numbers, you know, unless there's something wrong with the way we're measuring die-off, and that's a possibility. I don't know what that would be, but.
And we don't get an additive effect as we move down the watershed.
Well, yeah, you certainly would get an additive effect. I think there's sources all along the watershed, but. So let's imagine we're at the middle of the watershed and we have 1,000 E. coli. If using this kind of calculation, we might expect that a small minority of those have traveled a long distance, a greater majority have traveled a moderate distance, and that perhaps the bulk of those bacteria have traveled a relatively short distance. And of course, that all changes as flow changes. So.